Will Viadoom slow us to a snail's pace? Will Troy Kelly serve out his term as state auditor? It's the Week in Review. I'm Ross Reynolds, in for Bill Radke. Our co-respondents this week, Rob McKenna, former Attorney General for Washington State, Joni Balter, host of Civic Cocktail on the Seattle Channel, Claudia Balducci, King County Council member representing the Bellevue area. Welcome to all of you.
Thank you.
And we want to hear what you think about the news of the week. You can tweet us at KUOWWIR. Week in Review. Social media queen Bon Huberman is here monitoring your responses. Sound Transit 3, the multi-billion dollar mega project to build the next phase of light rail to Tacoma, Bellevue, and Everett, and other associated transit things. It's going to be on the ballot this November. The plan isn't complete. We know it's going to be very expensive. But this week marks the end of the public comment period for Sound Transit 3. Now, under the current draft plan, it could take decades to get to transportation centers like Ballard and Everett. Could we build it faster, but do we choose not to? Is this true? And if so, why go slow? Let's start with you, Joni.
I sort of don't buy the question. I think that the real thing that's going on is it takes that long to accumulate that much money to build something that costs $50 billion. It takes time to get the money to put it up, to back the bonds. That's the main thing that's going on. Yes, of course, Seattle and the region loves process, and we can work ourselves into some sort of dither over process. But I actually think that that's not the right question. It seems to me that this is exactly the conversation, however, that Sound Transit would like us to have. Instead of us talking about, is it too big? Does it go to the right places? Is it using the right taxes? We're sitting here talking about, hey, can we hurry up and get it sooner, faster? And there's sort of a disconnect for
me. You think they're playing us?
Yeah, a little bit. I mean, I think they have to propose their package, of course.
Sure.
But it just so happens that the package came out when we're opening to the U District. And all this fanfare.
Sure,
good timing.
I'm sure.
Way to go. Coincidence, yes.
How about you, Claudia Balducci? Do you think that we could be building this faster? Because there are complaints about the length of time it's going to take to get light rail to some of these places.
Well, I suppose this is the part where I should disclose that I'm on the Sound Transit Board. So I've been part of the planning and the rollout. You know, first of all, I think the timing, just going back to your comment, Joni, this year is it's a presidential election year. And that's really what's driving the timing of the rollout this year. We're fortunate in that there are some openings happening and people can see what they're being asked to buy more of. In terms of the timing and how long it takes, first of all, I hope people are aware that we're opening Sound Transit 2 projects every few years over the next several years. So we will have an extension to Bellevue and Redmond. We will have an extension to Northgate and other places. So it's not as if there's this lull where nothing will be happening. If Sound Transit 3 passes, we will then go further and open more lines over time. And two of the reasons for the timing are the financing. You really just can't afford to take the tax streams we have and build that much capacity all at once, unless you raise a whole lot more money. And the second issue is, frankly, the capacity in the region, the private contractor capacity to build.
Let me ask you this, though. What are the costs in gridlock we pay if we don't build it faster? I mean, there's huge costs associated with the amount of time people spend stuck in traffic. The longer there aren't alternatives, the more time will be spent stuck in traffic.
Sure. And that's exactly right. I think, you know, every hour that people spend sitting in traffic, those extra 3 weeks a year that folks on the south leg of 405 spend sitting in traffic is money to people, to businesses. But yeah, but you know, I guess I would say back to that if we vote no, if we don't do this package now, then we're going to be waiting even longer. There is a lot of work at Sound Transit right now, discussion about how to speed things up. There's certainly some speeding up that can happen in the planning process, potentially in some of the construction, but I wouldn't say that we could speed things up by 10 years. Maybe a couple of years would be doable, and we're certainly going to try to do that.
Rob McKenna, I guess your question wouldn't be could we build it faster, but should we build it at all?
Well, first of all, let me say I don't think it's a bad idea at all to spend $50 billion on transit over the next three or four decades. It's a good thing to do. We need to do it. We need to make other transportation and infrastructure investments as well. So then the question is, what's the right mix of investments? And the way you evaluate that is, what do you get for your money? How soon do you get it? And my critique of the light rail system has always been that it's too expensive and it takes too long and it causes an enormous opportunity cost in terms of not building other forms of rapid transit that we could have much sooner.
Such as?
For the same money. Well, bus rapid transit in particular, but also just more bus service, more park and rides in the suburban areas, connecting service in Seattle. Seattle, of course, decided they didn't want to wait, so they taxed themselves to add more bus service. Here's the thing. Just a little bit of history is worth considering. People got very excited in this region about light rail after they visited San Diego in the late 80s and early 90s, and they visited Portland, and they said, gosh, we should have that here. And absolutely. I mean, San Diego was building it for $15 million a mile. Portland was building it for, I want to say, $20, $25 million a mile. We're building it for $200 to $300 million a mile on average. It's just much more. It's 10 times more expensive than the idea that originally got people excited about it. What really enrages me is the sight of people in downtown Seattle and in suburban transit centers who literally cannot get on the bus, or they get on the bus and stand for a long ride in because there isn't enough bus service. I think that's where we ought to be putting this money.
I want to go back. I think you raised an important point, because we have kind of gone past the idea that, oh, we could be doing bus rapid transit, to the notion of we're going to build light rail, how fast do we build it? Is this a reasonable point that Rob raises when he says maybe it's time to take stock and think about doing light rail at all? We'll go to you first, yeah. Claudia.
I want to say that in the proposed Sound Transit 3 plan, there is bus rapid transit. There's bus rapid transit and light rail. So it's not an either or.
Right, but I guess his point is there could be more bus rapid transit and less light rail.
And, you know, we should be aware, though, that bus rapid transit isn't a magic thing. What makes bus rapid transit rapid, what makes it better than just local buses, is that it's separate from traffic. It's got its own right-of-way. And buying and building the right-of-way is what costs all the money. So if you build true bus rapid transit, say on 405, which we were driving up and down today, the state has sunk billions of dollars into building the lanes that will then be where the bus rapid transit rides. So if you were to take the whole cost of that, it starts to look a lot like the cost of light rail, because it's grade separated.
Joni, what about you? Do you think we need to reconsider?
Well, here's the thing. So I am for light rail. I'm for more light rail. But I feel like we're having this conversation just because this proposal's on the table without remembering some of the things that have happened literally in the last year to spend billions on transportation. There's the state gas tax package. Somebody correct me here if I get it wrong. I think $16 million. Seattle in November passed.
Million or billion?
Billion. Yeah. Billion. Seattle in November, billion. Seattle buses last year. We are all over this transportation thing. You should definitely add light rail to it. But this thing is huge, and it hits some taxes that we hadn't used before, like the property tax. And it also happens at a time when there are, like, so many other things on the ballot for the voters to pay for. So we have this sort of way that we talk about this. We have affordability. We're all into affordability. That's one side of the coin. And then in the very next breath, we go crazy with expensive spending on all kinds of things. And we're not shy on transportation here.
No. Rob, back to your point. You said bus rapid transit would be another way to go. But if you do need to have a separate right-of-way for bus rapid transit.
No, you don't. In fact, Claudia is right that you can define bus rapid transit as being dedicated right-of-way, but it doesn't have to have dedicated right-of-way.
Well, that doesn't get stuck in traffic then? It doesn't become slow by virtue of the fact that if it's in traffic with everyone else.
You have to compare it to what your alternatives are. Okay. All right. One of the alternatives is just regular bus transit, which is not as fast. But bus rapid transit utilizes technology such as traffic light control, so that the lights turn green when it approaches. It can use an HOV lane as it does on or could do on I-90 in the center lanes if we weren't going to lose those to rail. There are many models of it. It's revealing that we moved to bus rapid transit after we started to make the initial investments in light rail, which we've done on Aurora, we've done it in Bellevue and elsewhere. It's also revealing that in Los Angeles, after enormous cost overruns on the Red Line that cost a lot of poor people their bus service because they cannibalized the bus service to cover the cost overruns, they did what? They built bus rapid transit on Wilshire Boulevard and Ventura Boulevard. It works extremely well. Limited stop, traffic signal prioritization, et cetera. And my point is simply this. It's not grade separated, but then neither is light rail. It doesn't run on, in generally, and it's own right of way runs down the street in many places, except down towards SeaTac, which is another story, or in the tunnels, but that's what contributes to the enormous cost. My point is you can get bus rapid transit a lot faster. The demand is there. Why not get people what they want now and for the next several years and then scale it up to fixed rail when you have ridership that really justifies that investment?
Well, the package isn't complete yet, but it will be before voters this fall, and I've heard $400 a household, so it's going to be a very expensive thing for people to vote for. And back to you, Joni, and Claudia, will this long time frame we've seen, over 20 years to get to Everett, I think about 20 years to get to Ballard, be an inhibitor for people who might be considering voting for it? Because they'll like the idea, but they're not going to want to pay for so long before it gets there. What do you think, Claudia?
It's really a lot of what we're hearing. We're hearing a lot of comment back about we want to see it faster. And so going back to your first question, there's definitely work in the getting from the draft package to the final package to try to see what we can do in that regard, because I think you're right. I think people will want to vote for something sooner. Everybody does the math. I've done the math. How old will you be when this thing opens, and how old will my 10-year-old son be when it opens? But I go back to asking myself, how old will I be if we don't build it? Then we'll never have it. And honestly, mass transit is transit that can carry thousands of people an hour. A light rail train can carry up to 2,000 people per hour, and I'm probably actually getting that math wrong, but it carries a lot more than a bus does, and the operating costs can be lower.
Well, there are costs. There are a lot of costs to shortening the time span. You can get a 15-year mortgage and pay it off more quickly,
That's
or a
30-year
right. mortgage and go longer. But there are also a lot of regulations that are in place that slow the process. Is there any thought from you on the Sound Transit Board of reconsidering some of those regulations and some of that public input, which does have a cost to it in time?
Yeah, absolutely.
Like what?
I'm sorry. You guys tweeted about me, and it buzzed. So say the question again.
Well, to shorten the time frame.
Tweet interference.
Throw a flag.
To shorten the time frame to build this, to get it to places, one way you could do it would be to spend more money. Another way would be to not have as much process involved. There's a whole lot of input from neighborhoods,
yep.
environmental considerations. Is there any thought at Sound Transit of maybe we need to cut some corners here?
So there is actually discussion going on right now. We have a new CEO, Peter Rogoff, who is the former director of the FTA in D.C., and he's pushing us to have just exactly that conversation. We can be a lot less linear in how we do the kind of permitting land use decisions that need to happen in each of the local jurisdictions, get that done up front or simultaneously with the planning so that when the time comes to actually permit, it doesn't take 6 or 8 years. Maybe it only takes 3 or 4 years along with the environmental.
From the folks I've talked to, you can definitely shave a couple of years, maybe even more than a couple off of this by streamlining some of the permitting, by presenting fewer options. What happened with Bellevue? Come on, you guys, you know this story. They had so many different options to consider. That's what made that take longer.
Yeah, I think that's all true. But if you drill down, the core reason this is a 50-year or $50 billion 40-year plan or 35-year plan. 25-year plan. It only feels like 35 years. Is that
because you're waiting intently for it.
Oh, very much so. But it's because of the financing. Sound Transit got way out over its skis with its original plan to the point where it became obvious that the emperor had no clothes and the executive director lost his job as a result of a U.S. Inspector General report that figured out that they were fudging the numbers. They don't want to do that again. They want to be careful. But it is very expensive because you're not just talking about the upfront costs. For example, the $50 billion probably doesn't include the bond costs, the borrowing costs. So it's expensive. And I think, Claudia, you're absolutely right to take the time you need to finance this appropriately. I absolutely agree with that. My frustration is just that you could buy a lot more bus service sooner. Yes, light rail vehicles conceptually can carry 2,000 people, as you say, an hour. Wait till it starts running across I-90 and you start seeing the long pauses between the trains, and then compare it to how frequently buses can run and how full those buses are, and I don't think it pounces. We studied this with the East Lake, the Transportation Study Program, and found that bus rapid transit would carry just as many people as light rail would when you actually counted the number of buses who would run.
Quick final question for each of you. Do you think that this will pass in November, Rob McKenna?
Well, it's an awful lot of money, and people in Snohomish and Pierce County and in the suburbs are concerned. They're just not getting value for it. So we could see we could see history repeating itself where this package fails like the original Sound Transit package does, the next one passes.
John? I'm thinking that's the scenario as well, because that's the history of Sound Transit. The one they put up first is kind of like the big ask. Hey, do you all love this? And then they kind of fix it, snip, cut, you know, amend, and then it comes back and it's passed. However, they did pick, as you suggested earlier, 2016, because that's a big Democratic turnout. Hmm. And so that's the best year they could try.
Claudia, do you think this will follow the past record and this one might fail and another one will come in a couple
of years?
You know,
I'm going to be the optimist. I'm just going to go out on a limb and say, yeah, I think it's going to pass. I think that the reason that we're spending as much money as we are on transportation is because it's the number one problem that people identify with this region. They want to see solutions. I think they want to see a wide range of solutions, from roads to buses to light rail. And I think when push comes to shove, they'll be willing to pay for it.
More Week in Review with Claudia Balducci, Joni Balter, Rob McKenna, and you when our program continues. It's Week in Review. I'm Ross Reynolds in for Bill Radke with Rob McKenna, former Washington State Attorney General, Joni Balter, host of Civic Cocktail on the Seattle Channel, and Claudia Balducci, who's a King County Council member representing the Bellevue area. The state auditor's job is to conduct financial audits of government agencies to make sure they follow the rules. Washington State Auditor Troy Kelly was charged with financial malfeasance in connection with real estate records company that he ran before he got elected to public office. Well, this week, there was a decision of sorts in this case. Jurors acquitted Washington State Auditor Kelly on a charge of making a false statement, but they could not agree on the other 14 federal counts brought against him, including theft, money laundering, and tax evasion. Now, a lot of state officials called on Troy Kelly to resign when these charges were filed, including Governor Jay Inslee, Republican Senate Majority Leader Mark Schessler. A jury of his peers has finished deliberating. So my question for each of you, does this vindicate Troy Kelly's decision to resist those calls to resign? And should he just now be allowed to get back to work? Rob McKenna, you were Attorney General. Is this over?
It isn't over, because a hung jury means that there's the possibility of a retrial. And I'm guessing the federal prosecutors are sitting down and considering that very option for all 14 counts or for a subset of those counts. So until they decide not to pursue a new trial, it isn't over.
And based on your knowledge of how these things usually work, are they apt to file these charges again?
Well, it depends on what they think the reasons were for the hung jury. Was it because they couldn't reach a unanimous verdict on criminal charges, or was it something deeper than that? So they'll have to use their judgment based on what they think happened with those jurors. There was a motion for a mistrial that was brought at one point not long before the verdicts were rendered. They probably, and this is with the benefit of hindsight, they probably should have accepted that and started afresh, but they didn't. And they gambled and they lost and got a hung jury. Although, from their standpoint, that's better than getting 15 acquittals.
Yeah. Joni Balter, is this in a sense a vindication of Troy Kelly?
No, because here's the situation here. So this is, time flies rather quickly here if you think about it. I remember being an editor at the Seattle Times and editing one of the stories about this Troy Kelly business back during the election, his election. And who would have thought that he would spend just about the whole term defending himself sort of in this ongoing fight with prosecutors. And think about what the auditor does. This is sort of my overriding feeling about this. The auditor is kind of like a judge of how government functions. So almost there is a higher bar for who this person is. This person's supposed to be beyond reproach, not spending most of the time trying to defend his own prior behavior before he took this job. It kind of demeans the office as far as I'm concerned.
And it's disastrous for office morale. The reason I felt he should resign as soon as these charges were brought is that this is just a terrible, terrible weight on the hundreds of people who work in that office and do good work day in and day out. For no other reason than to do the right thing by the people who are working for him, he should have stepped down instead of keeping the title, keeping the job, waiving the pay, not going to work. It's ludicrous.
But I got to ask, do you have any firsthand information? If you talk to anyone in the auditor's governor's office who says, yes, we're really depressed because we're going through this?
Yes, I do, actually. I maintain contacts in state government, and I know this has been a terrible, terrible blow to morale there. It's embarrassing for them. It hangs over them like a cloud, and it would have over any agency.
I think Washington voters are embarrassed and depressed about this particular thing because of what we expect from the office.
Yeah, and you know, it illustrates how these down-ballot races just don't get the attention. They don't have the budget because they can't raise enough campaign money to really educate voters. So people tend to vote for whichever party they tend to vote for because they don't know much about the office. And sometimes people like Kelly slip through. I mean, it's amazing given the cloud hanging over him during the campaign.
Couldn't believe he still won.
Right. Claudia, yeah, I was surprised.
Claudia, now that prosecutors have failed to make their case against Troy Kelly, they might try a second time. Did these state officials speak too soon when they said he should resign after the charges were filed?
Absolutely not. I mean, you're not going to find any disagreement here. This function of government is so critical to the public's trust in everything we do. There can be no cloud. The bar has got to be higher than unconvicted. It's got to be something, you know, stronger than that. And frankly, I don't think that just anybody can be an auditor. Even if you have a perfectly clean background, you need to just, as Joni said, you need to be above reproach. You need to be trusted. And I hope people know that the auditor's office doesn't just audit the state finances. They audit every government at every level.
Right.
They sit in our offices at King County, at the cities, and those folks do an amazing job to keep government on, you know, flying right. And
it's
we
a
need
key
them
reason
to do
we
their
have
job.
Less corruption in our state than in most parts of the country.
Yeah. Joni? And I think if you went back to some of those politicians who called for him to resign, they would not budge. They would say we were right, because a lot of them took him aside privately and said, is there anything here? Should I be worried if I endorse you or pretend to support you? And he said no. And now they're the ones saying, look at this. We've spent so much darn time on this.
Well, I got to ask you this. Troy Kelly has not been at work a lot because he's been preoccupied because of this trial. And maybe you have some insight into this, Rob McKenna. Is there any sign that the work of the state auditor's office has flagged because of his absence? And as you say, there's low morale. I still get the reports every week of the audits being done. Is there any a concrete objective indication that his office is not doing the job it should do because he's been under this cloud?
I haven't seen it, but I'm not close enough to really detect the changes. I have to believe there's been some impact, if only on the amount of time that people probably spend worrying about it, talking about it, et cetera. It is a professionally run office, and so fortunately it doesn't rise or fall entirely on the back of one elected official. But these are hardworking public servants, and they deserve something better than, to your excellent point, Claudia, an unconvicted boss. They need a boss who can actually be there, do the job. There's a reason we have this position to begin with. It does add value. And so even if they're still managing to carry on and do the same quantity and quality of work, it's just so bad for them personally as people who, you know, have given up a lot to be in public service. It's not what they deserve.
Sure, I totally get that. But Claudia or Joni, do you have any firsthand information about the office's work not taking place because there's been this cloud over Troy Kelly?
I don't have any firsthand information, but I've run a government department before, and it was the jails department at King County. And I can tell you that we all at the front office could have walked out the door one day and never come back, and the department would have gone on just fine for a while.
True
for
confession.
Ooh. But if you don't have leadership, if you don't have somebody setting policy goals, setting, you know, keeping the tone, making sure that everybody's doing their job, eventually, like an airplane, it's going to start to lose altitude and eventually crash. And I don't think you know when that happens until the crash occurs. So it's really just critically important that we get that level of leadership back at the top.
Joni, what do you say?
Well, I don't have any firsthand information either, but what I do have is this sense that when the auditor releases a really amazing audit, that it should be the auditor who steps forth full power of the bully pulpit and full confidence of the people he's presenting it to. Hey, take a look at this, because this is something we found. This is something that can improve government. You don't have that here.
Yeah.
It ain't going to happen.
An example, would be that in the recent legislative session, funding for performance audits was gutted by the legislature. There's no auditor there to fight back on that.
Okay, good point. We in the chattering classes, and I include all four of us, are obviously hopped up about this story. We've been following it really closely. But Claudia, when you talk to your constituents in Bellevue, is this something they're talking about?
So at my level, the local level, I have not heard one complaint. Lots about light rail, not so much about the auditor's office. And I think it's partially because it's a step removed from direct service. We hear from our constituents about direct service. My bus didn't come. My pothole's not getting filled. The audit didn't get done. I don't think that people will notice that right away. And it's unfortunate because government as a whole can start to really lack in performance over time if we don't have that function.
Well, question for all three of you then. Why should people care about this? Is it a remove from their actual day-to-day experiences?
Well, it's something that Rob Reese said. This is why we sort of have a pure sense of our government. But not right now. This sours people because they know there's this din. It's not like they're all talking about it endlessly. Oh, my gosh, what happened to the auditor? And did he go to work today or not go to work today? But there is a sense of it that it sours the office. It demeans the office and it demeans government in general.
But, Rob, as you say, Washington State has a pretty clean reputation. Is this one incident really going to sour public opinion about government?
I don't think in general, but it's certainly not helpful when people read headlines about the auditor of the state being under indictment, going through a trial, et cetera. It's a steady drip, drip, drip that erodes public confidence over time. And if voters aren't talking about it more, it might be because they have lives to live and they trust their government to...
It's because they're on 405 stuck in traffic. Everybody knows that.
There you go. You know, they should be able to count on their government working right. And those of us who do understand the importance of the auditor and of the audits have a duty to step up and say, as we did across the board, that this man should step down from office and let someone else step in who can do the job.
What do you think about Troy Kelly and the other news of the week? Tweet at us. It's hashtag KUOWWIR. This is The Week in Review. Our social media queen, Bon Huberman, is monitoring your responses. More Week in Review with Rob McKenna, Joni Balter, and Claudia Balducci in just a moment. Former TV sportscaster Tony Ventrella is running for Congress against Dave Reichert in the 8th Congressional District.
I am running a crusade against big money influence in politics. If I happen to win the seat, that's a bonus.
A crusade yet. Ventrella is not the first media figure to challenge Reichert. Cairo talk show host Dave Ross tried and failed. But Ventrella does have an interesting angle. He says he won't take any big corporate campaign contributions. Would you vote for him? Tweet Week in Review. It's hashtag KUOWWIR. This is Week in Review. I'm Ross Reynolds in for Bill Radke with Rob McKenna, the former Attorney General of Washington State, Claudia Balducci, King County Council member representing Bellevue, and Joni Balter, host of The Civic Cocktail on the Seattle Channel. Joni, first of all, do you think Tony Ventrella will be the Democratic nominee to take on Reichert?
Well, so far, yeah, because he has the most name familiarity. There's a few other folks who, frankly, I hadn't really heard of. This is a crazy year in politics. This is the year of the outsider against the insider. No, I'm not saying Tony Ventrella will win, but he has a shot, a slim shot at this. And the way to do that for him is to run against Reichert as a symbol of a dysfunctional Congress, because that is a big sentiment right now, if you think about it. You know, Ventrella has some name familiarity. It's a little bit older. He hasn't been on the air for how many years, I don't know, but some number of years. Now, I do remember the Dave Ross race. I hosted a debate between Dave Ross and Dave Reichert. And I remember Dave Reichert being very nervous because it was a radio personality who would be very good in a debate situation. Reichert won that. You know, Dave Ross's name familiar did not win. And another point about this race, of course, is the fact that since 2012, the district has become more Republican than it was due to redistricting. It now stretches across the Cascades into Kittitas and Chelan counties. So it's a bit safer. That's the other side of this argument. And without money, Ventrella is going to have a heck of a hard time.
Claudia Balducci, this is kind of your stomping ground. You represent Bellevue, a big chunk of the 8th District. What's your sense of Ventrella's chances?
Well, I actually went online and looked at the map to see how much of it was still overlapping with my district, and almost none of it was. But the funny part is, on Congressman Reichert's webpage, the district is all in bright red. And I think that may be intentional. It may not be. But I think it's a good point that since it's been redistricted, it's a very hard district for any Democrat to really win. And I think I just heard Tony Ventrella say that he's trying to make a point more than he's trying to win the office. And it's a great point. It's a timely point. In some sense, it reminds me a little bit of what Bernie Sanders is doing at the presidential level.
Well, exactly. And I was really interested to see the news this week that Bernie Sanders, despite running the non-corporate campaign, has apparently spent more than the other candidates have. So it's worked out well for him. Rob McKenna, when it comes to Tony Ventrella's notion of just taking in small donations and not corporate donations, could this work for him financially the way it worked for Bernie Sanders?
Did he say he's not going to take corporate, or is he also not going to take big union contributions and big donations from other institutional sources?
I'll have to check that, but I think the notion was he wouldn't take those big numbers. But that's a good question. We'd have to ask him that.
You probably can't raise enough money from small donations in a congressional race because, unlike a presidential race, it just doesn't attract the same level of attention. If he thought he would really be competitive in this race, he probably wouldn't be limiting his fundraising in this way, to be honest. I mean, if it were winnable, he would say, I got to do whatever I can to win, because that's the more important thing. So this does seem to signal that it's a campaign more about an issue than about the prospects for success. Doesn't mean it's a bad issue. I agree with Claudia. It's probably a good year to run on this kind of theme. But it's hard to envision a scenario where he's able to beat a sitting member of Congress. The irony that we all notice, of course, is that approval ratings for Congress are ridiculously low. Is it currently 12%?
12, 11, 10, 9.
And the reelect percentage for members of Congress every 2 years is over 90%.
Yeah.
So it is a kind of cognitive dissonance sort of that I've always wondered about with voters.
Well, every 2 years, hope springs forth from the Democrats that they're going to find someone to take Dave Ricart down. You mentioned there's two sides to this. One is Congress has a bad reputation. Another is the district has changed a little bit to his advantage as a Republican. Is he vulnerable? What do you think, Joni?
Dave Ricart is not terribly vulnerable, other than the fact that he's tied to a dysfunctional Congress. That is the part where he's vulnerable. Another thing is, if Mr. Trump is at the top of this ticket, Rob, you're for
Kasich.
Mm-hmm. So one reason the party leaders, and I will include Rob in that, don't want Donald Trump is that he's easily the most disliked person in the whole state. That's not complicated. And so what happens is if he's at the top of the ticket, as we like to say, the down ballot folks really do suffer, because Washington Republicans are not kind of similar to Trump. They might stay home. They might, you don't stay home here, but, you know, they might just not bother with the whole thing. And so that does hurt. That does hurt everybody down the ballot.
Claudia Balducci, you mentioned the fact that the district includes a lot of strongholds for Dave Ricart, but do you see any vulnerabilities from him aside from the fact that he might be affected by the national ticket?
I really don't either.
Yeah.
It's much like we used to say about lawyers. You know, everybody hates lawyers, but they love their own lawyer. Everybody may hate Congress, but they seem to like their
goodness.
Own.
Thank goodness. I have to hasten that.
But they seem to like their own Congress people. And I can't think of any particular issue that Congressman Ricart has had in the last term or two that will cause him problems. His district is pretty safe. The Trump factor is very, I think, very unpredictable. Who knows what will happen if he's on our ballots? So that may be the biggest risk for him. I agree with you.
I think the Trump factor is unpredictable. I tend to believe it'll depress turnout on the Republican side, and I worry about that. But at the same time, we've been wrong. All of us in the establishment have been wrong all along about this whole phenomenon. And he does seem to be getting people out to vote who normally don't vote in presidential primaries, people who are just really, really upset with the status quo and are turning out to vote for him as a way to signal that. People who are shifting the party they normally vote for in some cases as well. So it's probably just too early to say exactly what the effects will be, this many months out.
Well, I've been speaking to a lot of Republicans in this season. And of course, we have the 24th. On the 24th, the primary takes place where Republicans will decide who they want to send their delegates to vote for. An Elway poll showed Ted Cruz and Donald Trump tied at 11% in Washington State. Now, all
you brought that up.
Yeah. All the Republicans I talked to said they knew that Trump people were out there, but they were some ephemeral bird that was in the bushes. They didn't know where they were. Well, now we actually have some data suggesting they are not only there, but they are in equal numbers with the other leading contender, Ted Cruz. Does that surprise you, Rob McKenna?
Yeah, it does, in the sense that I can't really name any Republicans I know who are Trump supporters.
But Don Benton, did you see the phone call on Facebook? It was hilarious.
I didn't see that, so now I know one. Excellent.
You must
go. Don Benton is the state senator who's
the
chair
of Trump. Let me explain that Don Benton used to be, briefly, I should say, the chairman of the Republican Party. Briefly, he shaked his head.
Very unsuccessful.
And this hilarious video that's on Facebook was a bunch of people gathered around a phone, sort of bowing down to the phone, Don Benton was, and in comes a phone call from Donald Trump. And at first I thought it was like a joke, but actually it was definitely Trump. It was definitely Trump, and he was going, how about May 7th? Does that seem like the right day for me to visit? He said it differently. I'm not using his accent. And they were all, yeah, that's the great day. Yeah, come here May 7th. So Don Benton.
I guess if I had to pick one Republican who'd been in office, it probably would have to be Don Benton from Vancouver, Washington, leaving the state Senate.
Here, we didn't get through a show without talking about Trump, so we're there.
See, he's still.
You know that
it.
Your ratings just went up because of that.
There are two.
How about all of the ways the media promoted Trump's meme that that John Kasich doesn't cut up his pancakes properly? So all of a sudden, you get all this footage that the networks and the cable guys are putting up saying, there's a picture of Kasich eating pancakes.
Rob, you brought it up again.
You're just collaborators.
You just repeated the meme.
I know. By criticizing, I repeated, oh, my God, I'm part of it now.
Oh, your God, you are part of it. I thought the food thing was beneath all of us.
Trump, my point earlier, Trump is not a Republican. And a lot of the people who are coming out to vote for him are not Republicans. But Don Benton aside, I mean, that's the thing. It's so weird about it. He's taken my party from me, and it just – I find it very, very dispiriting.
Do you think Cruz has a different impact down ballot?
I think he probably does. I don't think he would depress Republican turnout in the way that Trump would, not as much.
Final quick answer on this question. If Donald Trump comes to Washington State, I've heard some Republicans saying this is going to be crazy. Every radical from the entire Northwest will come to protest. It'll be a fiasco. And others saying, yeah, that's kind of the point. What kind of impact would a Donald Trump appearance be in the greater Seattle area?
It'd be Bernie Sanders and Westlake Mall all over again.
One can only hope. If Donald Trump did come, I would guess that he would probably come more to my neck of the woods than to downtown Seattle. Certainly, if I were his logistics people, I would plan for him to be somewhere else outside of the city of Seattle. But I imagine that it will draw quite a bit of protesting. On this whole topic, I have to say I don't talk about it too much. I don't find myself because what he's winning right now is the media war. The votes are a percentage of a percentage of a percentage. It is the people who are, Republican enough to vote in a Republican primary in a presidential year. And I think this is all going to come to a screeching halt when we get to the general.
Joni, quick response.
Don't hold me to this, but I think the locations that were announced for May 7th were Spokane, Vancouver, and a Puget Sound place to be named later.
I'm not inviting him. I want to say not
inviting. Perhaps a barge floating out on Elliott Bay.
I want to be clear. I'm not inviting him to Bellevue.
Okay. But all right. Claudio Balducci, King County Council member representing Bellevue. Joni Balter, host of the Civic Cocktail on the Seattle Channel. And Rob McKenna, former Attorney General. More Week in Review in a moment. I'm Ross Reynolds. It's Week in Review. I'm Ross Reynolds in for Bill Radke with Rob McKenna, former Attorney General Joni Balter, host of the Civic Cocktail, Claudia Balducci, King County Council member. This week in pot, a couple of stories to hash over. In a recent sting, couriers delivering marijuana to customers in Seattle hotels got busted. Well, Seattle Police Chief Kathleen O'Toole wants felony charges filed, but King County Prosecuting Attorney Dan Satterberg has declined the chief's recommendation. Satterberg says the city's stings amounted to arresting low-level couriers at the very low end of the supply chain. So who's right? Let's start with the attorney on the panel. Claudia Balducci, what do you think?
Well, it's of course the case in criminal justice that the prosecutor has got a great deal of discretion as to what they charge. And they make these kinds of decisions all the time on all different kinds of crimes, including other types of drug dealing. The voters have spoken very clearly around here that they want marijuana to be legalized. And so I can understand where Prosecutor Satterberg is coming from when he says that this is not a high priority crime for his office. To me, what this does is it once again underscores the problems with legalization by initiative. I supported legalization, but doing it the way we did, any number of very significant details were not worked out the way they should have been in a legislative process so that when we get to actually implementing the legalization, we have problems like this that could have been predicted and resolved ahead of time.
Rob McKenna?
Well, Claude is absolutely right. The prosecutor has discretion, and he has to allocate resources, you know, because he doesn't have unlimited resources, so he has to prioritize them. And Dan Satterberg has pointed out there are other ways to deal with this problem, including using the civil legal system, which they use to shut down illegal medical marijuana operations in parts of Seattle. So there are options to charging these low-level careers with felonies. And I think he's right that this isn't the best use of resources in his office, given that we're trying to figure out how to get people who are guilty of drug crimes out of prison who have been sent there for felonies. The other part of this, which I find is very interesting, is that this seems to be designed in part, the arresting of these couriers address the fact that they represent competition for the pot retailers. Mm-hmm. So we're protecting the brick and mortar businesses by going after the Uber equivalent, if you will. This. And that's kind of interesting.
Joni Balter, maybe you know the answer to this. As I recall, voters in Seattle ruled that marijuana should be the lowest priority.
Absolutely.
For police.
They did that a while ago.
Right. And now it's county prosecutor Dan Satterberg who's making it a lower priority, but the police chief is making it kind of a high priority by saying she wants to charge these guys with felonies.
So from what I'm hearing, the reason this is a thing at all is a breakdown in communication that normally happens. So usually when the Seattle Police Department is about to undertake something like this, they make a phone call or an email or whatever the heck over to the prosecutor's office and they coordinate. For some reason, that didn't happen this time. And so that's why you have these two different opinions. But I end up where you started your question. And that is, what have the voters said about this? The voters don't want pot to be a felony. And I, I'm not into the delivery of it. That's not in the initiative. And they are arguing that they're delivering things in addition to pot that definitely wouldn't be covered by the initiative and any of that. But it's a closer call in there. This does seem to me to be largely a communications breakdown, and it's about the use of resources. And so if that phone call had been made, maybe they wouldn't be sending these communications now. And I end up, I guess I err on the side of we don't want felony charges with pot right now.
So let me argue the other side of it
just
a minute, because I know Chief O'Toole, I have a lot of respect for her. And,
I do as well.
And for her officers,
yeah, absolutely.
Right? So the other side of it is this. To your point, Claudia, that we enacted legalization by initiative. And there are a lot of holes in it. Mm-hmm. But the fact is one of the promises made under this system is that it would be a regulated, controlled system that would keep the pot out of the hands of kids, mm-hmm. that would be taxed so that we could control it fiscally as well, and these delivery services are evidently undercutting that regulated system, much like bootleg liquor could. Maybe it's the marijuana equivalent of moonshine. Mm-hmm. But also, the Seattle police have pointed out that these delivery guys are, at least anecdotally, delivering other drugs as well. Mm-hmm. So they may be part of a network. I mean, after all, if you're making the delivery anyway, why not take the illegal oxycodone along with the pot you're delivering? So I understand the chief's rationale that, if we're going to have a controlled system, you actually have to enforce those rules.
Pot story two this week has to do with you, Claudia, and the King County Council this week approving a 4-month emergency moratorium on applications for marijuana producers, processors, and stores in unincorporated King County. Just to be clear, that's the part of the county that are not in cities. Claudia Balducci, how did you vote on that and why?
I voted in favor of the moratorium because similarly to what I was saying before about planning out how we're going to do implementation of the legalization of pot, what we were finding is in the unincorporated rural areas, there's increasingly clumps of processing facilities and grow operations in places that maybe were not intended under the regulations as initially adopted by the county council before I was there. What we find in the urban unincorporated areas is that there's clumping potentially of retail outlets. And so these are not necessarily desirable things you want to have happen. They can cause problems. They can drive crime and overutilization of a certain particular kind of land use. We need to tweak our regulations. We need to fix them and get them right. And so what we called was a timeout until we could do that.
Does this raise to the level of an emergency, though? I have to admit, I have not been into the areas of unincorporated King County that are affected. Is there an emergency there?
So the purpose of calling it an emergency was to be declaring an emergency was to be able to enact the moratorium immediately. What happens when you put a land use timeout on in any way, in any place, is that folks who want to establish new land uses, if you do it and you give your typical 2 weeks, month-long notice period, they'll just go and file their permits, and they will get grandfathered in, and then any change you make will not apply. And so it defeats the purpose of the moratorium in the first place.
Joni Balter, what do you think about this? Is this just reasonable business regulation?
So I've written many pieces about Washington and Colorado's pot measures for Bloomberg View. And I will tell you that this sort of appeal of those measures, Washington's in particular, was the fact that it was heavily regulated, very controlled. People made jokes that it was too controlled, too regulated. But now, this many years later, we're seeing some of the sort of the problems, the things that weren't addressed. This came up, as we all know, with edibles. I mean, there were...
You agree there's a problem here.
I agree there's a problem, and I agree that it was well known, let's say, that even though it's heavily regulated, that it would need to be tweaked as it went forward.
What do you think? You can tweet at us at KUOWWIR. That's Week in Review. Now, under Washington law, the King County Council is perfectly within its rights to regulate marijuana businesses in the way that they have done. But I guess my question is, should local areas have that ability to do that? Are they just kind of creating shortages in those areas that are going to create more crime in those places if they exercise their options? Rob McKenna?
Well, actually, I think it is within their authority. I mean,
it is within their authority, but should it be, I guess?
Yeah, I think it should be. I mean, look, we depend on our local governments to make decisions that affect neighborhoods and communities, and they're the best position to make such decisions, I think. And this is not the first issue where this has come up. If you think about decades ago, the debate over movie theaters that showed porn, or you think about debates over industrial uses, or there's a reason that we give the zoning power in our government system to the local government, the unit of government closest to the people and where they live. And I think it's appropriate for them in this case as well, given that there doesn't seem to be a shortage of access to this product as a general rule.
You can get home delivery, apparently.
Apparently.
Do you think the local...
From DoorDash to DoorStash.
Well, as you probably know, Colorado, when they were a little bit ahead of us, they approved their measure the same year we did, but they had their stores open quicker than we did. And they made a big deal. They allowed counties and cities to opt out like crazy, and they did. They have a certain portion of Colorado that's just not involved.
Claudia, you were critical of the way that we approved this by referendum. You think we should throw it out, or you think we just have to work with what we've got?
No, we're many steps down the road now to working out the things that need working out. We are where we are, and that's part of the reason I think to do the timeout, not a ban, a moratorium is a timeout, because we need to get the regulations right in order to continue to have public support for legalization. I want to maintain that public support. I don't want to lose the public because we allow things to happen that they say, this is not what I meant when I voted yes on legalization.
Yeah, like all laws that are adopted by initiative, it's just a law like any other now, and it can be updated, amended, changed based on actual experience, and that's appropriate in this case as well.
This is KUOW. I'm Ross Reynolds in for Bill Radke on The Week in Review. Up next, Via Doom! It's round five of Week in Review.
I've been thinking about the viaduct closure for many days. I'm quite concerned about it. I'm afraid it might be the implosion that does all of us in.
I've told my boss I'll be late for work. I'll be driving from North Seattle to Tukwila. I usually take the viaduct. Our employer has taken away telecommute probably for 300 to 400 people. So it's used to be able to work from home. Now we're not. So I will be on I-5 late for work.
I'm lucky in that I live in Wallingford and work in Ballard and Magnolia, so I have a 5 to 15 minute commute to work no matter what the traffic's like. I can't imagine being somebody who has to sit in traffic for an hour every day. That would kill me.
The implosion that will do us all in, merely late for work, or to paraphrase David Croman's story on Crosscut today, what if no one cares? The Alaskan Way Viaduct, a major north-south route through Seattle, is closed for 2 weeks while the tunnel machine Bertha passes underneath. I'm Ross Reynolds in for Bill Radke with Rob McKenna, former Attorney General for Washington State, Joni Balter, host of the Civic Cocktail on the Seattle Channel, and Claudia Balducci, King County Council member representing the Bellevue area. It's Week in Review. Does this shutdown affect any of the three of you personally?
Yeah, it affects anybody who's driving north-south in this region. Today was kind of not that big a deal, but hey, folks, it's
Wait till
Friday.
Monday.
I'm happy to work at home. I'm happy to telecommute and all of that. So Friday's not a good judge. And what happened last time, I think we'll see this very similar. Everyone's going to start out super freaked out. They're not going to get on the road. But then they'll hear reports that it wasn't that bad. So then gradually the traffic will build. That's my prediction. I don't know that. But that's what it seems like will happen.
Claudia, did this affect you? And what do you think there'll be a larger effect?
There definitely will. We know that our transportation network, all the state routes and highways are at maximum. And that means that they're not very resilient. So things like overturned fish trucks can shut the whole system down, and not just the road that the fish truck is on, but the entire system. So we'll see traffic on 5. We'll see traffic on 405. I think we've lived through these things before, though. So to sound just a little bit of optimistic note, we've lived through total shutdowns of I-5, 90, 405, 520. Not this long, though. So what we really need to keep reminding people is to, you know, for 2 weeks, you've got to come up with an alternative plan. And the good folks at Metro would want me to remind you that there's transit options, and you can find them at kingcounty.gov/get-ready.
And it does affect. It's interesting. We discovered this during the Nisqually earthquake, or the aftermath of the Nisqually earthquake, when the viaduct was shut down, how the shutdown of that corridor affects east-west patterns as well. It wrecked traffic and the ability to commute in on the bridges, for example, because all the traffic backed up from I-5. So it's a super important corridor. And I think, frankly, this underscores, notwithstanding the headaches with Bertha and the expense of tunneling, why the tunnel is in fact the best option. Because if you don't replace a viaduct, it's going to collapse. If you replace it with another structure, it's likely to not survive a severe earthquake. And this is an extremely important corridor for regional mobility.
Do any of you think the Department of Transportation might be gilding the lily a little bit here, kind of blowing up the impact via doom in order to scare people out of driving?
Absolutely.
Absolutely. No, that's question. What works.
In
it doesn't work. Other words, it doesn't work the other way.
What do they call it when I-5 shut down? Carmageddon? I mean, this is a tried and true method.
But if it's not Carmageddon, then it's like, oh, they lied to us.
Los Angeles had carpocalypse a few years ago, and they scared everybody, and it kind of worked.
It actually did work.
That's how
the key is, and this is a key distinction from the earthquake, of course, is that we can plan for this. We know it's coming. The problem with the earthquake, of course, is we didn't know that. I'll never forget my colleague at the time, Greg Nichols, walking to the courthouse from West Seattle because it was literally faster than trying to get there by car, and apparently couldn't ride a bicycle. But it was astounding how bad the traffic was as a result.
Well, let me circle back to something we talked about earlier in the program, and that's this transit proposal this fall, Sound Transit 3. Does a nightmare traffic situation, do you think, affect votes in November on that plan?
Now is too early to affect that.
I agree.
A blip right now.
Yeah.
I think it could. I mean, it certainly gives people something to remember when they're sitting at home with their ballot, how bad things were and how nice it would have been to have a nice speedy light rail line to take. Frankly, we see the West Seattle ferry. Actually, the ridership goes way up during these viaduct closures. People do find other ways to get around.
Let's see. I'm 30. I can use my AARP discount when the light rail finally comes to my neighborhood.
Ooh, one last jab. One last story. We've been blathering about what we think is important, but what are the news stories you're going to be talking about with your friends and family this weekend, Claudia? Or not even news stories. What are you going to be talking about?
Well, I don't know if it's a news story, but we're going to see Newsies. I'm taking my son to go see the musical at the Paramount Theater because he's a big musical fan. So we'll be at Newsies.
About newsboys.
About newsboys and a labor strike around the turn of the last century.
And how about you, Johnny? What are you going to be talking about this
week? I'm going to say, why not play the woman card? Women are 53% of the Washington state electorate, 53% of the national electorate. Let's play it.
That's a full deck. I'm going to be talking about the Mariners and Seahawks with my sports-minded family because the NFL draft is this week. We just landed with a 31st pick. A giant of a man, 6'5", 325 pounds. It makes me wonder how much he has to eat to maintain that metabolism. And the Mariners, I mean, who thought? You know, here they are. They were in first place briefly this week. They're now, I think, in second place by a half a game. But hope springs eternal there, too. So I think this is going to be a good sports weekend.
Go Mariners. Rob McKenna, former Attorney General for Washington State. Joni Balter, host of Civic Cocktail on the Seattle Channel. Claudia Balducci, King County Council member representing the Bellevue area. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you, Ross.
And thank you to Amina El Sadi for producing our program, Jeannie Yandel for editing it. Bill Radke's back next week. I'm Ross Reynolds.